Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week on the local theater front, a couple of conversations with Lauren English, who is starring in Bell, Book, and Candle at the SF Playhouse through January 19th, and with playwright, actor, dramaturg, and director Ben Fisher of the Cutting Ball Theater. The Cutting Ball's new experimental play festival is underway starting next week, and we'll talk about these free performances. Bay Area Fado singer Ramana Vieira is also in the house. She'll be appearing next week at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley and will share some of her music with us. And for 2013, a new feature here on Open Air. On the first Thursday of every month, critic Joshua Cosman will offer his cultural picks for the month ahead. Stay tuned. Cutting Ball Theater continues its 14th season with Risk Is This, the Cutting Ball New Experimental Play Festival. The festival runs tomorrow, January 11th, and every Friday and Saturday evening through February 9th. My guest, Ben Fisher, is a playwright, actor, dramaturg, and director. Ben's new translation of Czech playwright Josef Čapek's 1921 masterpiece, The Insect Play, is part of the festival, and he's also Cutting Ball's resident dramaturg. Ben has appeared on the stage or collaborated in some way with many other theater troupes, including Campo Santo, Stanford Summer Theater, Marin Shakespeare Company, New Conservatory Theater Center, among several others. And his original plays and translations have appeared in a number of festivals. He also wrote the screenplay for the feature film S.E.R.P., which will be released later in the year. Ben, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll talk about your role in bringing the insect to the festival in a moment. But I'd like you first to tell us a little bit about the Risk Is This Festival. I understand that this is one of the only festivals in America that's solely dedicated to experimental works for the stage.
It is, yeah. Risk Is This is a series of five workshops, and we're presenting these five experimental plays and new translations of experimental work to the public for free in a series of staged readings. And what I like about the festival is that it gives our audience a great window sort of into the playmaking process. We've chosen five scripts, two translations of seminal experimental work from this past century and the century before, and then three new plays that are haven't been performed anywhere. And we rehearse these plays for a week with the actors and directors and designers. We really get a chance to explore the world of each play and imagine what it would be like in a full production. And then on Fridays and Saturdays at the end of the week after the rehearsal, we present these plays in a reading to our audience. It's free to attend. These are open workshops. And then following the reading, we have a chance to speak with the audience in a talk back and sort of discuss the work and the process and see where these plays will go on to next, both in their artistic development and their future productions or things like that.
There must be so many works to choose from. What is the selection process like for your festival?
Well, we have a submission window where we take solicitations for new scripts, and I think we're looking for plays that other theaters might be hesitant to touch. I mean, as the title implies, you know, we're interested in work that's risky, that makes bold experimental choices in terms of form and style, and that's really pushing the boundaries of what we expect to see in the theater. So, you know, I get hundreds of submissions in every fall. I read through those submissions with our reading committee, and then we narrow the list down until we arrive at the five plays for the festival. Two of these plays, Ubu Ra and The Insect Play, are, you know, already established plays, maybe not very well known to American audiences, but plays with a huge lasting influence on the theater. And we're with those plays, we want to do new, fresh translations of those works really to bring out the qualities that make them such important pieces. And then with the other three plays, I think we're interested in work that does things that are a little bit different with language or with staging that changes the way in which we think about live performance and explore what those things feel like in the mouths of actors and with a solid week of rehearsal to really get in and dig into the material.
Tell me a little bit about this Uburoi translation. It's a translation by Rob Melrose. From what language? It's a parody of Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Right. Uburoi is probably one of the most important pieces of the avant-garde. It's a play from the mid-19th century by this French playwright, Alfred Jarry. So it's translated from the French. And it caused a small riot when it premiered in Paris. And it's sort of held up today as one of the first pieces of modern experimental theater. So Rob did this translation along with a number of other translations of this play Pelias and Melisande by Maurice Maeterlinck, the play Voitsek by George Buechner, which are now available in an anthology through the Exit Press. But we've never had a chance to really work on this play in depth with a director and with actors. So we have this wonderful Russian director, Yuri Ernov, coming over to work on the play for a week and just to see what it feels like in performance. And it's this totally wild, irreverent parody that borrows from Macbeth and from Hamlet and other Shakespeare plays. It's very fun and totally raucous.
Well, the work that you're involved with, the insect play, mm-hmm. is by Josef and Karel Čapek, and they were, I didn't know this, the best-known literary figures of liberated Czechoslovakia after 1918. What drew you to this piece, and is this a translation from the Czech, or is it a variation of an English translation?
Well, I don't speak Czech, so I worked with Czech speakers and arrived at a literal translation, and then from that literal translation, you have the sense of the language, but the play really relies on a lot of puns, and wordplay, so I sort of had to take it a step further from there to make it seem conversational and fluid. The insect play is a great kind of undiscovered gem, I think. Josef and Karel Čapek were, you know, widely popular, as you said, during their time, but I think just, you know, since the 1920s, they've really sort of fallen out of the public eye. But this piece is this amazing allegory about the human experience told through these little scenes with butterflies, ants, and beetles. And it's, like Uburoi, it's both wildly funny and totally irreverent, but also very, very moving and very powerful. So I've been a fan of this play for a long time. Rob and I are both huge Čapek fans. And I started working on, you know, this all the translations that I found were rather unfaithful to the original tech, actually. They would delete scenes or they'd add new characters. I mean, really strange choices. I don't know why the translators made those choices. So we wanted to get back to sort of a pure version, and a version for six actors, because the original play involves a cast of 30, but it's not really necessary to have all those extra people on stage anymore, nor is it very feasible. So this is sort of, I think, in some ways a return to the original impulse that the Čapek brothers had creating the piece, really trying to honoring their original intent.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Czech theater tradition and maybe its relevance for contemporary theater?
Absolutely. I think that a lot of what happens in Eastern Europe sort of presages some things that we see in the American theater in terms of absurdism and expressionism in the theater. Josef and Karel Čapek were a brother team. Josef is a set designer, and Karel Čapek is a novelist and an essayist. And so their plays are very visual, really luscious and widely imaginative. And I think that some of the staging techniques that were very common in the Czech theater at that time in the 1920s and 1930s sort of carried over into experimental work in the 60s and 70s in America. A lot of American playwrights saw their work. Arthur Miller was a huge fan of the brothers Čapek. I don't necessarily think his work is very stylistically similar, but the sort of dreamscape that they have in their plays might have influenced plays like Death of a Salesman or After the Fall. But I think that, you know, what's interesting about experimental work is that there can be an innovation in one time in one country that doesn't always necessarily carry over to other writers in a different era or in a different country. So we have these wonderful isolated pods of innovation, but, you know, with things like the Iron Curtain or World War II kind of coming in the middle, some of those techniques don't always translate as directly into our modern sensibilities. So the influence is there, but the origin's been lost, maybe.
This fascinating story of the insect play. And you mentioned Rob Melrose is directing it, and it'd be interesting to see a fully staged version of this because butterflies, ants, and beetles are being used to explore all kinds of human vices.
Well, I think the great thing about the festival is that all these plays, you know, really made us sit up and wonder what it would be like to see a full production. That's sometimes, you know, a little bit difficult in a reading, but in Risk Is This, we actually work with a set and a costume designer through the week of rehearsal. Those sketches are available in the lobby for the audience to come and see. And I think that's really great because we're not just exploring these things as pieces of language, but really as pieces of theater, things that would involve, you know, a visual element as well as an audio element.
So these staged readings are actually, there's some stage and scenery involved with these.
Well, we don't build any scenery really, but we have the sketches and the design, and I think that then the talk back, you know, the directors and the actors discuss what it's like to, what it would be like to put these plays on stage. Typically with a stage reading, you know, in most professional theaters, you might have about 8 hours to rehearse. We rehearse for 20 hours. So it's enough time. It really feels more like the first week of a rehearsal for a full production than just a workshop. We've got a lot of space to explore the language, to refine our approach to the play, and to imagine what this would be like on the stage in its full form. And many plays in Risk Is This end up in our full season in future years. So it's very exciting for our audience, I think, to see the first few steps we're taking with each of these plays. And I think that's interesting as well. You know, people who can attend the workshop and then attend the full production, they can see the way the play grows and transforms, the way that we're thinking about it as a theater, and how, as we explore the text, we make new discoveries in terms of the staging and the visuals.
Talking with Ben Fisher about his role at the Cutting Ball Theater as dramaturg, and I want you to maybe share with the audience, our radio audience, the different, what do you do as a dramaturg versus what you would do as a director?
Well, dramaturg is kind of a hard title to define. I like to think of it as an advocate for the writer. A dramaturg, you know, the role of the dramaturg changes based on the needs of the production. But a good dramaturg, I think, is someone who's interested in the text and who's there to advise the director and the playwright, if it's a new play, about the way in which the language is working in performance. So, for example, on a classic play like Ubu Ra, you know, I might do some research into the original production. I might explore different approaches directors have taken over the years towards this play and really try to dig into the language and understand the writer's intent. So if there's a scene or a line that doesn't really make sense, or that's puzzling for the director and actor, I might be able to help uncode that or offer some suggestions, or at least just provide a second opinion. And for a new play, you know, like Superheroes or Passing or Sidewinders, the new plays we have in the festival, I think I'm there both in the service of the director and at the service of the writer, helping them as an editor, helping them, you know, really clarify what their intent is and making sure that whatever's on the page sort of matches what's in their mind. And as a playwright myself, I think it's sometimes very hard to understand how the performance process changes the meaning of your work. I think that's one of the great things about writing for a collaborative form is that you're not the sole person who's interpreting the language. You've got, you know, the work of the actors, the work of the directors that add a new layer of meaning and a new layer of complexity. So the dramaturg, I think, can provide that second set of eyes and really help the writer clarify their intent and streamline their approach.
Well, thank you. I've always wondered what was going to happen for a dramaturg.
Right, right.
The Cutting Ball Theater's Risk Is This experimental new play festival runs tomorrow through February 9th. All the information about the
It's January 11th.
So January 11th, a week from
next Friday, yeah.
A week from Friday through February 9th. Information at cuttingball.com. The plays Superheroes, Passing, Sidewinders, Ubu Ra, an insect play in Ben's translation from the Czech or their adaptation thereof.
Right.
All the information at cuttingball.com. Ben, before we end our time together, tell me a little bit about this feature film for which you wrote the screenplay, SERP.
Right. Well, this is actually adapted from one of my stage plays. I had a workshop at the Dragon Theater in Palo Alto as part of the New Play Development Factory back in May, and one of the actors had a friend who is a filmmaker in San Jose, this director, Mark Schwab, who came and saw the reading and, you know, thought that it would be interesting to see a film version. I'd never worked in film before. But it was really a wonderful experience. You know, they shot it over the summer, and we've actually just finished our final edit of it right now. But it was very interesting translating something that's designed to be staged into cinema, because cinema is so much more intimate, and there's a much more visual element to the storytelling. You know, you can communicate a lot non-verbally through film that you might not be able to do in the theater. So it was a really sort of unexpected and delightful experience.
Very nice. Well,
yeah.
Look forward to hearing more about that.
Thank you.
I should also mention that Cutting Ball Theater announced today that the company has been awarded a generous grant from the Andrew Mellon Foundation to fund a 3-year residency for resident playwright Andrew Saito. The grant will give Saito a salary, health benefits, a Cutting Ball for an entire 3 years, and the grant is Cutting Ball's largest grant to date. Congratulations.
It is. Yeah, we're very excited to have this grant and to have Andrew with us, you know, as a dedicated resident playwright. One of the things I really like about Cutting Ball, and something that's really drawn me to the theater over the years that I've worked there, is Cutting Ball is willing, I think, to embrace a lot of work that other theaters might be reluctant to approach. And I think that what's really wonderful about this festival is the plays are all very inventive in terms of their style and their form, but they're also just good plays. You know, they're dynamic and they're emotionally engaging, and they really challenge the way that we think in a delightful and unexpected way. And each of them do that in a different sort of in a different method. And Andrew's writing really, I think, encapsulates a lot of what makes Cutting Ball so exciting. Andrew is extremely smart and very inventive, but his plays all have this really wonderful emotional core. And I think the opportunity to have him, you know, working at our theater, having him on a salary and just allowing him just the opportunity and the time to write plays is wonderful. As a playwright myself, it's very hard, I think, for, you know, to balance the economic challenges of working in the arts with the desire and the necessity to create. So I think that, you know, with this festival, Risk Is This, and with future Risk Is This festivals, we're really interested in not just, you know, experimenting in the same way, but finding what experimental means in 2013 or 2014 and not what it might have used to what it used to mean in 1982 or something like that. So it's a very exciting process to be a part of.
We look forward to seeing the fruits of that 3-year residency. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Ben Fisher, break a leg or whatever it is one breaks as a dramaturg. I don't know. Do you break some other part of your body?
Who knows?
And thanks for coming into the KLW studios.
Thank you very much for having me.
My next guest, Romana Vieira, has been described by Mundo Português newspaper as the new voice of Portuguese world music. She has headlined the world's largest Portuguese festival, the New Bedford Portuguese Feast in Massachusetts, and has performed at the 2010 Encontro Festival in Macau. One of her original songs, Unido para Amar, was played for the 2006 Winter Olympics opening ceremony, and she was chosen to sing for the 50th Grammy Awards special Music Cares benefit, which honored Aretha Franklin. She and her ensemble will be performing at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley on Friday, January 11th. And she and Michael McMorrow, who plays guitarra in the ensemble, now join me in Studio A to talk about the festival and the unique vocal stylings that is the Fado tradition. Romana and Michael, bem-vindos, KALW.
Obrigada, foi um prazer.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the Fado tradition? But first of all, you really are the story of local girl makes good. Born in San Leandro, you studied performing arts at ACT here in San Francisco, and you've established quite an international reputation for Fado. Could you tell our listeners first, what is Fado?
Sure. Thank you so much for that introduction. Fado music is basically, it's the folk root music of the Portuguese, much like how tango is the music from Argentina, flamenco represents Spain, Fado is the music of Portugal, and the translation is fado is fate or destiny. So I'd like to call it like the folk root music with an emphasis of very similar to that of the American blues. It's very cathartic.
I did hear some fado when I was in Lisbon a couple of years ago. It's absolutely entrancing music, and it's a very stylized way of performing, too.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what happens as a performer. You're not just singing in front of a microphone. You've got some movement involved.
Well, they say a fadista, which means a fado singer, is somebody that's born a fadista. It's not something that you learn. And I think it's just... It's very similar, reminiscent of like a blues singer, you know, somebody that is a good, soulful, gritty blues singer. I don't know if that's something that can be learned. So fado music is in the same fashion in that it's you have to just reach in the depths of your soul and really feel the feelings and emote. It's a very emoting, if there's such a word, type of music. You have to really feel deeply.
And in addition to the blues kind of feeling, it's the Portuguese word saudade is involved.
Yes.
So
yes,
that's kind of hard to translate, though.
It is. They don't. They say that we don't have the correct translation for the word saudade. It means tenderness or a longing, or I think the best way to describe it is our American word of yearning. And you pronounce it in the Brazilian way, by the way.
Saudade.
Yes, which is great.
I understand you mentioned that a fadista is born and not made, but you came rather late in
kind of sideways,
life.
Yes.
But there are some deep roots of Portuguese music in your family.
Yes, there is. My grandfather on my father's side was a musician, sort of a closet musician. It's funny because I come from a family of closet musicians. We're all very musical and we're all very sort of private about it in a way. As my mother grew up singing to Amália Rodrigues, the famous fadista out of Portugal, the legendary fadista, and, you know, sang it day in and day out. And I just learned this through osmosis, through her. And then my grandfather was also a famous composer in Madeira, I guess semi-famous. He composed music. Again, this was all very under the radar. It was like we were in sort of denial with really wanting to take that full frontal until I came along.
Hmm. Michael McMorrow, you're playing guitarra in the ensemble. How does the guitarra and fado playing differ from a regular folk guitar or other guitar playing?
Oh, the guitarra is kind of like it's similar to a mandolin or in bouzouki or oud, and it's used as sort of an adornment instrument with a lot of grace notes. And it is an instrument that has, like, when we talk about saudade and yearning, the guitarra really is a big part of that. It really
cries.
Has an unusual sound, yeah, a crying sound.
Yes.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that music, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the upcoming performances.
Okay.
What cut are you suggesting from this CD to get a good flavor of fado?
Let's see. Well, we have Maria Lisboa, number 8.
Great. Tell me a little bit about the song.
Maria Lisboa is a play on words. It's many women in Portugal have the name Maria, my mother included it, and then Lisboa. So it's sort of a play on words talking about Lisbon, the capital of Portugal.
Faudista Ramana Vieira on KALW.
Chinela, tem movimentos de gata na canastra, a carabela, no coração, a fragata na canastra, a carabela, no coração, a fragata, em vez de corvos do chai, Cai voltas bem em pousar. Quando o vento lava o baile, mala no barco no mar. Quando o vento lava o baile, mala no barco no mar. É da conchas o vestido. E nas veias o latido do motor de uma traineira. E nas veias o latido do motor de uma traineira. Bendições e marzia, tempestades à pragoa, seu nome próprio Maria, seu Lisboa, seu nome próprio Maria, seu apelido Lisboa. Marazia, tempestades a pregoa, seu nome próprio Maria, se apelido Lisboa, seu nome próprio Maria.
That's Ramana Vieira. Ramana Vieira and Ensemble will be performing at La Peña Cultural Center on Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley on Friday, January 11th. Ramana and guitarist Michael McMorrow join me in studio. I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air on KLW Local Public Radio. That's some really beautiful music.
Thank you so much.
That's from the CD called Ramana Vieira, Lágrimas de... you're going to have to help me on this.
I can do it. Lágrimas de Rainha.
Oh, please.
Tears of a Queen.
Very nice, very nice. And information about that CD and everything Ramana is doing is at ramanavieira.net. I'll spell that out for you. R-A-M-A-N-A, V as in victory, I-E-I-R-A.net. We'll put this up on our website as well in case you don't have
you.
Pen and pencil handy. Now, these performances at La Peña... you'll be doing some traditional ballad-style fados, and that will pay homage to the late queen of fado, Amalia Rodriguez, along with some new compositions. Who was Amalia Rodriguez?
Well, you know, I always use her in the present tense, who is she, because what she is for me is very much a role model. She sang fado for 50 years, and then I'd like to say that she... I think what was so unique about her, well, first of all, her voice is unbelievable. She has probably one of the most amazing vocal instruments. And this is the fadista that I grew up with, that I grew up listening to, that my mother played her records and sang all throughout, you know, the house and in the kitchen. You know, whenever she was cleaning the house, she was singing to Amalia. So I grew up listening to this amazing singer, and then of course I did research on her, and she basically, Amalia took this music for, she had a 50-year career span, and she traveled all over the world bringing fado internationally. So she was, I guess she was really one of the first fadistas that, I mean, there's many fadistas, many wonderful fadistas. I think Amalia's legacy was that she really went international with it, just traveled all over the world.
It's wonderful that you're keeping this tradition alive by paying homage to her. And
thank you.
And you're also creating new works as you're going along here.
Yes.
So is this concert all being sung in Portuguese?
The way we work these sets, we do a first set where we pay the traditional homage, as you said, to Amalia Rodrigues, and then in the second set, after we've maybe hooked in everybody, we we venture out and we do this delicately with our own original music. I have a five-piece ensemble, and everybody's very, very gifted. Michael here, the guitarista, is an incredible songwriter. So we're actually in the studio working on a new record. So you will be hearing songs in English. There's always a Portuguese theme weaved into it, even though we might be singing in English, and then we have the traditional instrumentation. So we're trying not to go too far out of the boundaries with this, but we do want to share our original interpretations and creations.
That's lovely. And the CD that's currently out, Tears of a Queen, includes some of your own compositions.
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, Michael McMorrow and Ramana, we look forward to this concert next Friday, the 11th, at La Peña. More information can be found at, not only for tickets, at lapena.org, lapena.org, but at Ramana's website, ramanaviiira.net. Ramana, Michael, thanks for taking some time today. We're going to close with some more music from that CD, Tears of a Queen in Coimbra. Thanks for being here.
Muito obrigada.
Ana Vieira, an ensemble performing Coimbra from her CD, Tears of a Queen. You can hear Ramana and her ensemble at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley next Friday, the 11th at 8 p.m. Information at lapena.org, lapena.org. Still to come here on KALW, a talk with Josh Cosman about the month ahead in classical music. But next, another trip to the theater. My guest is Lauren English, who is starring in John Van Druten's play, set on Christmas Eve, Bell, Book, and Candle, now at the San Francisco Playhouse. Lauren, welcome to Open Air.
I'm thrilled. Thank you.
I guess we can throw in Bothered and Bewildered as well, as far as your character, Gillian Holroyd, is concerned. Now, she was portrayed by Kim Novak in the 1958 movie version. Mm. Tell us a little bit about the plot.
Bell, Book, and Candle is a romantic comedy, or rom-com, as we call them now. It starts off in a beautiful apartment in Greenwich Village with a lonely witch who, in our production, is listlessly throwing lightning bolts into the sky. And she wishes for something different, and knocking at the door comes a man who lives down the hall, brilliantly played by Jimmy Stewart. Will Connell in our production is lovely and captures that whole essence, Jimmy Stewart's essence, beautifully. And she makes him her prey. She casts a spell on him that he will fall in love with her, classic love potion number 9 style. And he does, and they fall in love. The trick of this play is that there's a few drawbacks to being a witch. One, you can't cry, you can't blush, and you can't be in love. And so, though she wants this connection, it only runs so deep. The trick is that if you do fall in love, you lose your power. And so eventually his charming ways win her over, and she's rendered helpless to her heart opening to him. And so it has a beautiful ending, and it's a classic story of girl falls in love, doesn't quite tell the truth, truth gets found out, guy runs away, comes back, she's changed, and they both sort of complete each other in the end, and it's really quite touching.
You mentioned as did I, the movie version, which starred Kim Novak. You mentioned Jimmy Stewart. Also, Ernie Kovacs was in the film, Jack
That's
Lemmon,
right.
Elsa Lanchester.
Yeah.
It's one I just threw on my Netflix just because I've got to see this film.
Yeah.
And among other awards, it won a Golden Globe in 1959. It's a story that the classic 60s sitcom Bewitched is based on, in part. Now, I kind of take for granted at my ripe old age of 49 that, of course, everyone knows the series Bewitched. And I'm wondering, of a younger generation, how, if at all, you might have encountered Bewitched and then related it to your work on the play.
Right. No, I totally remember watching Bewitched. It was on Nickelodeon when I got home from school. They did reruns. Thankfully, you know, I got some tasteful old television when I was a kid. I absolutely remember it, and it's charming and wonderful, and I still think completely enjoyable. You know, now, of course, my generation, we've got vampires, Breaking Dawn, Twilight, and True Blood, and it's the sort of witchcraft has formed a darker, more edgier place in pop culture now. But that sort of wistful, fun, charming witchcraft, that mischief, you know, it really sort of ended in that era with Bewitched and Bell, Book, and Candle and more charming stories like this. Now it's a lot more dark and mischievous. So people hear witchcraft and they go, "Ooh, I don't know, is it going to be gory?" And not Bell, Book, and Candle. Bell, Book, and Candle really captures that old essence.
Well, this is being done at SF Playhouse in its fabulous new space. Tell us a little bit about the work that you've done in bringing SF Playhouse to the new space.
Yeah, I just returned from New York a year ago, where I was went to graduate school and working professionally. And I came back, I moved back, and sort of immediately took on the role of education director and helped sort of develop some educational programming and casting director. And I came back at this pivotal point in the year, which for the theater leaders is called, you know, picking the plays, finding the plays for next season. And it's something I've always helped my father and supported him. And so we were looking for this piece to come at Christmas, and we want to honor the holiday and find something that people can bring their kids to, but without hitting it on the nose. Year before last, we did a period of adjustment, which is a lesser known Tennessee Williams play that has a softer, more family friendly ending. And I came across Bell, Book, and Candle online. A friend of mine was doing it at Hartford Stage, and I saw some pictures, and I went, ooh, that looks cool. What's that? And I emailed my dad and said, well, do you know Bell, Book, and Candle? And he goes, oh, my God, Bell, Book, and Candle. Oh, yeah, I saw the play. I read the play. I saw the movie. And he immediately just took it and ran with it. I actually hadn't read it before I recommended it to him. And so he said afterwards, well, you're going to do it, of course. I said, okay.
Nice, sure. Nice different take on the holiday. That's super.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned in passing Bill English, who is your dad, artistic director of SF Playhouse. Now, what's it like working with him as your director?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's absolutely heaven and hell. You know, I mean, it's like it when it's good, it's the best. I mean, getting to make art with a parent, with a family member who I happen to share the same aesthetic for art and theater with. I mean, it's completely triumphant when it works. And when we push each other's buttons and you know, those triggers that only a parent can pull for a child, it's hard. And over the years, we've had to develop safe words, as it were. We have certain rules, like he's not allowed to come up on the stage and show me how to act something, because he likes to act things out for me. And I'm not allowed to disagree with him in front of the other actors.
That's a nice detente, or at least a nice working relationship.
Yeah, it keeps it fairly safe.
And of course, you can't be fired. I think that's part
right.
Of, yes,
that's right.
It goes without saying on that one.
I might get a stern phone call after rehearsal is over, but or a long email. But for the most part, we do really well, and it's totally fulfilling to be able to create art with someone you know that well.
So this is going to be running through January 19th. So like if haven't got enough of your holiday fix, you can still experience it into the January month.
That's right.
But what's coming in for you? I know you're doing work with the Playhouse on the administrative level. Are you doing some more on the front of the stage after Bell, Book, and Candle?
Yeah, I have a lucky year with them. I get to do Reasons to Be Pretty by Neil LaBute, which I think is a Bay Area premiere. It's a hot title, and my stepmom is directing it, Susie Damolano. She's a wonderful director, and I'm really looking forward to working with her again on that. It's a four-hander, and it's really current and edgy, and brings
Let's back up a step, a four-hander.
Yeah.
Let's get our radio audience tuned to that. What's a four-hander?
Four-hander is four people in the cast, so it's a small cast.
Well, that would be eight hands, wouldn't it?
Well done, sir. It's true, yeah. It's an eight-hander, and it's really a great play. It's very contemporary, very edgy, and she's really good at bringing those contemporary plays to a real natural place. So I'm thrilled to be working with her on that.
Very nice. The play is Bell, Book, and Candle, now at SF Playhouse, running through the 19th. You can find out more information at www.sfplayhouse.org or the San Francisco Playhouse box office, 415-677-9596. Go see this fun show, a different take on the holidays. Lauren English, thanks so much for taking a little time today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, David.
You're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. I'm David LaTulip, your host. And for 2013, a new segment we hope to foster and create as the months forge ahead. On the first Thursday of the month, I'll be joined by Joshua Cosman, music critic, classical music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Joshua, no stranger to the KALW airwaves, as a regular panelist on Minds Over Matter, Sunday evenings at 7. Joshua, welcome to KLW during the daytime.
Thanks, David. It was easy to find my way here, but it sure looks different in the daytime.
You don't want to look too closely.
All right.
And Happy New Year to you.
Thanks so much.
So let's see how this goes. January 2013, what is something you're looking forward to on the classical music front?
I've got all kinds of things that I'm looking forward to. You know, this is the time of year when things finally start to pick up a little bit, and I always look forward to that. By the middle of December, I'm a little tired out and ready for vacation, and then by the beginning of January, I'm ready for things to pick up again. Probably the biggest thing coming up, I would say, this month is the opening of the new concert hall at Stanford in Palo Alto, Bing Concert Hall. This has been a bumper year for new concert halls. We had the wonderful Weill Concert Hall up in the Green Music Center at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park.
What was that like? Did you go to that?
Oh, I did. It's a wonderful, wonderful hall. Very very open. You know, it's got these kind of big open air, open sides and backs that can be very adjusted according to the time of day and the weather and whatnot. The acoustics are terrific. I've heard the Santa Rosa Symphony now, which is going to make its home there. They sounded very good in there. There's been some chamber music. There's a wonderful new concert series that they've got going up there.
What's the seating capacity of the hall?
I don't know. If I'd known we were going to talk about the fall, I would have. But I don't have that figure.
It's a significant concert hall.
It is. Well, it's certainly it's big enough for an orchestra to play, and for chamber music, and for solo vocal recitals, and for various kinds of pop and rock configurations. So it's a multi-use hall. And now we're going to get another one down the peninsula at Stanford. That's opening up on January, the weekend of the 11th through 13th.
What's being presented there is the opening.
The opening night is going to be the San Francisco Symphony with Michael Tilson Thomas, and Frederico Vanstad is going to join the orchestra.
Lovely.
The St. Lawrence String Quartet, and Anna DeVere Smith is going to MC, and various of the Stanford affiliated musical groups. So they're going to do a program of a lot of American music, and some a string quartet by Haydn, a little Debussy, and various other things. We're not sure exactly what else is going to fill out the bill. Saturday night, Los Lobos, the great Tex-Mex band, who I don't ever get to cover them, but I love to listen to them. And then Sunday afternoon, the St. Lawrence String Quartet, which is the quartet in residence there at Stanford, will be joined by the pianist Stephen Prutzman, who's an absolutely brilliant composer and arranger and pianist as well, a man of many talents. And they've got so we'll get a chance to see how the hall works for all those different kinds of music.
This really is the first significant concert hall for the campus, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a brand new thing. I mean, there's a constellation of different halls down there, but you know, this will be a sort of a multi-use facility that'll be home to orchestras and visiting performing groups of all different sizes and sorts. That's good.
On the subject of new concert halls, another beat you don't cover, the new concert hall opening up right downtown across
for SF Jazz. Yeah. I was going to say so we've had in 1 year, you know, three big new concert halls. It's sort of a confluence of such developments that's not that usual, I have to say.
Anything else coming up with the San Francisco Symphony that you're looking forward to in January?
Yeah, that's where I was about to go next.
What do you know?
This coming week, actually, they're going to be opening the new year with a new piece by the British composer and scholar Robin Holloway, who's a really interesting character. He's a composer and also a Debussy scholar. And sort of equally brilliant on both fronts, which is sort of one of those things that they only do at Cambridge and Oxford, you know. Michael Tilson Thomas has had a long-standing relationship with Holloway. This is the fourth new piece that the symphony has commissioned from him. This is an arrangement of Debussy songs. Settings of poems by Paul Verlaine, which will be sung by Renee Fleming. If it's anything look like some of the other pieces that he's written for the orchestra, it should be terrific. The history of Robin Holloway's premieres with the symphony has been sort of funny and spotty. He wrote a fourth concerto for orchestra. He's written several concertos for orchestra, and the symphony commissioned him to do one for the orchestra. And the piece that he wrote turned out to be so long and so huge that when they came to do the world premiere this was in 27, they cut two movements out. They just sort of left them on the floor. And to this day, we have never, it was a seven, I mean, admittedly, it was a seven movement piece. And uncut probably would have run about an hour and 40 minutes, and they had contracted with Christian Tetzlaff to play the Brahms violin concerto on the same program. So something had to give, and one can't fault them for it, but I still begrudge them that those two movements that we still haven't heard, because the five movements that we did hear were so terrific that every year when they announce the new season, I make it a point at the press conference of raising my hand and asking Michael Titi, you know, when are we going to get the other two movements of Holloway's fourth concerto for orchestra? And they haven't made good on it yet, but
wow.
I'm going to stay on them because, you know, that's what I do, is bug people until they do what I tell them.
And that's coming in January.
So that's coming, actually, this coming week, a week from today, on the 10th through the 13th. So that will be, with Robin, Renee Fleming as the soloist. One other thing that I'm really looking forward to later in the month, towards the end of the month, on the 28th of January, the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players, which in my estimation has been really having a kind of a renaissance since the arrival of their new artistic director, the percussionist Steve Schick. They're going to do a performance of all Steve Reich music. And you might say, well, okay, haven't we heard that? That, you know, there's nothing very daring about that. And there's some truth to that. These are contemporary classics, especially the clapping music, which comes from the early 70s. And David Tannenbaum, the great local guitarist, is going to play electric counterpoint. But the big piece on the program is Music for 18 Musicians, which is, you know, Steve Reich's great masterpiece from 1970s. And what's interesting to me about, I mean, aside from the fact that I think it's really one of the most inventive and beautiful and remarkable pieces of the 20th century, is that it is only in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years become available as a repertoire item for other performers to play, like the contemporary players. You know, for a long time it was the sort of private domain of Steve Reich and musicians, which was his hand-picked ensemble of instrumentalists. And I remember once talking to him, maybe it must have been about 10 years ago, he had just gotten the grant from somewhere to hire a graduate student to actually transcribe the piece and publish it in, you know, usable, in a form that was usable by other performers. And until that time, the piece, the written music for the piece had existed in these sort of handwritten individual parts with notations that said things like, you know, here Bill walks over to the marimba, or, you know, Bob takes over from Jack at the
it's quite choreographed. Yeah,
it is choreographed, but it was all very specific to those guys. You know, it was like these were the people who played the piece.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because I've, as a chamber musician, I've often been involved with ensembles and used someone else's music, and it's like, cue Gene. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, wait a minute, is that the clarinetist? Is that the cellist? What do you mean, cue Gene?
Right, it's a shorthand that works until it doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
So they finally got that piece transcribed, you know, in proper grown-up fashion.
let me back up for just a minute before we hear a couple of the highlights. Now, as a music critic, and we read you in the San Francisco Chronicle, probably some other places as well, where your brand is being expanded, I'm wondering if you were trained by a mother to say, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. Or how do you find that fine line? Obviously, you want to protect people from going to something that's going to waste their time.
Uh-huh.
But you also need to...
No, I was trained by a mother whose stated motto in life is she wants to be known as someone for whom the best was barely good enough.
okay.
But yeah, no.
A striver.
Yes, exactly. So, I'm not a believer in if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all, except in personal interactions, of course. But
are you obligated to write about something, or did you say, well, you know, I'm just not going to
really
do this?
Oh, I think so. I have on very, very rare, I'm trying to think if there's been ever any occasions when I have said, you know, that wasn't even worth writing about at all. But I don't think so. I mean, on a very practical level, there's so much going on in the Bay Area musically, and there's so much that I can't even get to, you know, that by the time – by the time anything makes it onto my schedule at all, there's a fairly strong presumption that this is a serious undertaking and worth, you know, critical commentary of one sort or another.
You must be, you know, people must ask you, oh, please come to this, please come to that, but your calendar must be dictated.
My calendar is very full, and most of the time that's a source for pain, and every once in a while I'm very delighted to be able to say, gee, I wish I could, but, you know, my dance card overfloweth.
Or to go to the classic, you've done it again, whatever that is. So tell me more about January and this month.
Well, those are the, excuse me, one other thing that's coming up in late January on Sunday the 27th, Cal Performances, which has really had a very strong record for contemporary music and for new music of all kinds, is presenting the British pianist Nicholas Hodges, who's not very well known here, but a very prominent contemporary music champion from Great Britain. He's going to be playing a piece written for him by Sir Harrison Birtwistle called Gig Machine, about which I know nothing except the title, but I'm looking forward to hearing that. Birtwistle is always an interesting character, and he's going to also play music by Debussy, Stravinsky, and something by Busoni. So that's sort of in the wild card category.
Mm-hmm. SF Performances is also starting a new series with Bob Greenberg and the Alexander String Quartet this month. So we're looking forward to those and hopefully broadcasting those.
Oh, are you? Yeah, good. Yeah. What's the yeah. That's always a plus. Bob and I go back a long ways. Bob and I were in graduate school at UC Berkeley together when he was...
Really? I didn't know that.
Nevertheless, it's true. This was when he was doing more composing and less explaining other people's compositions.
Well, he's always entertaining and enlightening with the way he ties things together.
It's true. He's a wonderful talker, and I envy that very much. I've always been a big fan of his music and wish that I sort of resent anything that takes him away from the composition table. But, you know, a man with that many skills has to parlay them into whatever he can.
Now, you don't cover ballet, but you do cover opera, I believe. Is
yes.
that correct? So opera is on hiatus while the ballet is in residency?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, they have just the one facility between them. So it's a matter of dividing up the year between them. So,
is there anything at the ballet, musically speaking, that you're looking forward to, or do you attend the ballet?
I do attend the ballet, but always as a rank amateur. You know, I keep my opinions on the subject completely to myself. I think it's an interesting sort of. It's a sort of an interesting tradition in this country that many times critics are expected to double up, on opera or on classical music and ballet as though they were the same or similar kinds of things. I'm not sure that they drink at the same well, as at least in my experience, as much as some people believe that they do. Ballet and dance in general is something that I like and am fond of and am interested in, but would think it really a dereliction of duty to weigh in on professionally.
Well, Joshua, we hope to continue these conversations on the first Thursdays during Open Air. So the next time, I hope you pencil in your calendar, would be Thursday, February 7th, where we'll talk about the month of February.
I'll be here ready to go. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. You can read about Joshua's reviews about classical music in the San Francisco Chronicle. sfgate.com is where you can go and do see some archived things as well there. And when's your next appearance on Minds Over Matter? Do we have you on the books yet?
That is still under discussion. I had a date and then I've had to reschedule it, but I will certainly be here one of these Sundays. It's a regular part of my schedule that I always look forward to.
Well, thanks so much, Joshua, for staying with us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Open Air for this week. I'm David LaTulipe. Join me next Thursday at 1 for another edition of all things, well, most things, culturally considered. Open Air on KALW.